This one is going to be mercifully short, at least when it comes to hearing my voice. This is a special edition of Stating the Obvious. I am going to be posting a speech by somebody else.
You can scream and shout with all your might.
Oh, you can scream, shout, whine, cry, snivel, piss, moan, whatever your little candy ass wants to do. Shove your opinions up your ass. That way your head has something to keep it company.
Either you are wrong or I am right.
And by now, you know the third option. You are wrong and I am right. Why? Because that's just how I motherfucking roll. It's early in the morning. I'm still drinking coffee. I'm still waking up. And yet this is still Stating the Obvious, brought to you by the Cynical Libertarian Society. It is the weapons platform from which I launch the cruise missile of my intellect that homes in on and destroys dumb motherfucking statists all around the world, all over the fucking place. No fucking statist can escape the cruise missile of my intellect, because I'm that goddamn good. That damn good, jabroni. All right. I'm going to shut up in a minute, and I am going to be playing a speech I recorded by Nicholas Carr. He wrote the book, The Internet. But no, all right, hold on. As I said, just drinking coffee. He wrote a book called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. It's a very good book. And I'm posting this, first of all, because it's good stuff. It's important. You should read this book. But also because this is part of a build-up for upcoming series I'm going to do, where I'm going to be sitting down and talking about this book and some other books that are similar to it. I'm going to get to it one of these days. The thing is, it's one of those projects that's so immense that I keep putting it off. You guys, you procrastinate. You know how that is. Speaking of procrastinating, you know, it's like the first episode in a month because I've been working my ass off in the theater industry. So anyhow, that's coming. This is a prelude to that. This is good background information for that. And then there are going to be some new episodes coming up, because I'm going to get some recording done today and this week. We're going to get some stuff out there. But anyhow, so yeah, there it is. This is Nicholas Carr. I forget. Randy, when... Do you remember when the date was on that? Yes, 29th of August was when he actually gave this speech. This was here in Fort Collins. So, I mean, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm going to shut the fuck up now, and I'm going to play the speech. Sound quality is not very awesome. I was recording it on my Zoom H2, which is an amazing piece of equipment. However, the Zoom H2, due to just how the room was set up and everything, was more or less sitting on the ground. And by more or less sitting on the ground, I mean it was sitting on the ground. How's it like more or less? Oh, that's right. Thank you. Randy's pointing out I haven't had enough coffee yet. So, anyhow, I'm going to drink some more coffee. I'm going to record some more after this. But for right now, I'm just babbling. So I'm going to shut the fuck up. I'm going to play the speech. This is Nicholas Carr, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. All right, there it is. Let's kill this and insert the speech and publish.
I'm Holly Carroll, Executive Director of Blue River Public Library. Welcome to the fourth author series that is sponsored by the Blue River Friends of the Library and the CSU Friends of the Library. To my left is Dean Patrick Burns of CSU University Libraries, and he will be introducing our author tonight, Nicholas Carr. This has been a wonderful partnership, and I just love this community because you come out to hear our authors and to support all the intellectual activity and all the literary events in this community. So I want you to give yourself a round of applause. So without further ado, here is Pat Burns, and he is going to introduce Nicholas Carr, author of The Shallows.
So I left my hard copy notes in my office, and I'm part of the malaise that Nick Carter will be talking about tonight. Now my friend in the second row, Judd Harper, said I had to start off with an Ogden Nash poem or two. My favorite is The Bronx by Ogden Nash. The Bronx, no the Fox. My second favorite is Eagles. I like eels except as meals and the way they feels. So, some months ago, I was directed to the book that Nick wrote called The Shallows by Laura Crabtree, one of our previous provosts, and said, this is the most important book that I've read in a long time. You have to read it. Nick is a Pulitzer Prize winning author. He writes about technology, culture, and economics. In his book he'll be talking about tonight, The Shallows, what the internet is doing to our brain. Is a 2011 Pulitzer Prize nominee and a New York Times bestseller. In 2008, Nick wrote a cover story for The Atlantic that posed the question, is Google making us stupid? In the piece, he argued that the ever-increasing amount of time we spend online might be eroding our capacity to read carefully and think critically. And that's just, it just frightened the bejesus out of me after I read this book as an academic. He actually makes the assertion that it's changing our brains physiologically. He's been a columnist for The Guardian in London and has written for The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Wired, The Times of London, The New Republic, The Financial Times, and other periodicals. He's a member of the Encyclopedia Britannica's editorial board of advisors, from the steering board of the World Economic Forum's Cloud Computing Project, and writes the popular blog Rough Type. He's been a writer in residence at the University of California, Berkeley, my alma mater. Earlier in his career, he was executive director of the Harvard Business Review. He holds a BA from Dartmouth College and an MA in English and American Literature and Language from Harvard University. Holly and my commitment to you are to bring great authors to Fort Collins. Please join me in welcoming a great author, Nick, tonight.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Dean Burns. Thank you, Holly. I really do appreciate the support from the friends of the CSU libraries in the Hoodoo River Public Library District. And thanks especially for all of you to come out this evening. I'm really gratified by the attendance. I should mention also that before this event, I had the opportunity to go over to the Morgan Library on the CSU campus, which has been recently remodeled and is now reopened in effect. And if you haven't had an opportunity to go over and take a look, it's really beautiful space for learning for students. So I would recommend making that trip. I'm going to illustrate my talk with a couple of pictures on the screen, and I understand I can see that some of you are quite a ways away from the screen, so I apologize if you can't see it, but it's not really that important. but when I was putting together, thinking about my presentation, thinking about my talk, I tried to come up with a good image, a good photograph to kind of set the stage and get across what I think is happening to us in a technological sense and in a deeper sense than that as well. And so I did what, of course, everybody does when they need to find a photograph today. And I went to the web to see if I could find one, but I wasn't having any luck. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a guy from Hawaii, who I didn't know, never met, sent me an email, and he attached this photograph, which is a photograph, he was reading my book. He wasn't reading it in a paper copy, he was reading it on his Kindle app on his iPad. And this is the picture, and he looked around him at his workspace while he was reading this, and he was struck by the fact that he was living kind of what I was describing as he was reading my book. And if you look, he's got his iPad there, and he's got next to that his iPhone, which is running, he's got his computer, his iMac in front of him. So in addition to being a good advertisement for Apple Computer, it really gets across the environment that we've created for ourselves, a new environment, in just the last few years. And on the one hand, the fact that this guy that I didn't know could reach out to me and connect with me and share a photograph with me, tells us that there are important benefits to this new technology. And really, we gain a lot by having access to all the information that pours through it and all the connections it makes possible. But he also said that he was nervous about what had become, in effect, his new environment in which he lives. And he, you know, he made the point that the technologies, the tools that started off being there to help us with particular jobs, particular tasks, had changed their nature. And his own relationship with the tools had changed as well. He used to be the master of the technology, and the technology was the servant he called upon to do these things. But now he sensed that he was becoming the servant, and the technology was becoming the master, kind of intruding on him all day long. And as it happened, that was kind of exactly the same experience, personal experience that I had had a few years earlier, and that inspired both originally the article, the Atlantic article, Is Google Making Us Stupid? And then from there, the book, The Shallows. And I particularly noticed this change when I'd sit down to, for instance, read a book or read a long article. And I realized that I was having trouble doing it. I was having trouble maintaining my concentration on one thing. And I've been a big user of technology for a long time. I've written about technology for about a decade. Used to be at least an early adopter of gadgets and services and the online world. But it was making me nervous as well, because I realized that something seemed to be changing inside my brain, inside my mind. And of course, my first reaction was to say, well, maybe, you know, this is middle-aged mind rot setting in, and this is just what happens when you get older. But and maybe there's a little bit, but the more I really thought about it, the more I looked into my own experience, I realized that my brain really wanted to behave the way it behaves when I'm online, when I'm looking into a computer screen. It didn't want to stay focused on one thing with undivided attention. It wanted lots of stimulus, lots of information coming at me in different forms, lots of messages. And so when I cut off the flow, I was having trouble shifting gears, shifting mental gears. And all, it started to strike me that it was almost as if I had trained my brain to be distracted and not to be able to pay attention. So that set me off on two lines of research, because of course I wanted to know if this was even possible. Could just using a tool really change the way a person thinks? And even change the way they think when they're not using that tool, which is the experience I was having. I began by looking into recent neuroscientific evidence and research about the effects that technology has on our brains and our thought processes. And I'll get back to that shortly. But then the other line of research was to look back into history at earlier examples of technologies that became widely adopted to see if you could trace a pattern of them affecting the way people thought. And what quickly became apparent to me is that among all the many tools that human beings have invented and used throughout history, there's one set of them, and it's a fairly small set, but I think an extremely important set, that are tools that we use to think with, what I call intellectual technologies. So all the tools that we use to gather information, to arrange and categorize information, to store information and to express ourselves, all of these things that kind of extend the powers of our mind instead of our physical bodies. And if you look at the history of these kind of technologies, you do see, I think, a pattern from very early on of them affecting in a very deep way the way we think, the way our ancestors think, and on up until today. And I believe you can go all the way back to a very early intellectual technology. In fact, this predates history. It's the technology of the map. Maps are so commonplace and something we rely on in various forms all the time that we don't even think of them anymore really as tools or technologies. But at one point, somebody or some group of people had to invent the map. And if you think about how we made sense of where we were, how we situated ourselves in space before the map came along, it was purely based on our sensory perception, what we could see around us, maybe what we could hear. That's how we thought about space and thought about place. As soon as you introduce the map, you get a very different idea of space and place. Instead of relying on your senses, you have an abstract picture. And this is a radically different way of thinking in general, not through sensory perception, but through abstraction of that sensory perception. And of course, you can imagine, and we know today, of all the practical uses of maps. Suddenly, people could go from one place to another with confidence that they'd get there, even though they'd never been there before, because somebody plotted out the route. You could start having the idea of boundaries and property and so forth, But something deeper happened. If you look at history of map making, of cartography, one of the themes is that once you introduce this abstract picture of reality, suddenly people start thinking in more abstract ways in general. They start paying attention, really for the first time, of patterns that lie behind what their senses tell them. And so we have this radical shift in the way people think in this much more abstract way as a result of the spread of this technology and the increasingly intensive use of it. I think you see something very similar, though much, much more recently, with the introduction of the mechanical clock. Mechanical clocks really were only introduced around the 1300s or the 1400s. So in the greater scheme of things, that's really fairly recently in human history. And before we had mechanical clocks, we experienced time and understood time as this ongoing natural flow. And to the extent that we used any kind of tools to monitor it, they were tools that emphasized this flow. So a sundial, for instance, or on a bigger scale, you know, great stoneworks like Stonehenge that tracked the movement of the sun through the year. As soon as you introduce the mechanical clock, here too you get a radically different way of thinking about time. Instead of this natural flow, we suddenly begin to perceive time as a series of precisely measurable units, seconds, minutes, hours, and so forth. And once again, beyond all the practical uses of the mechanical clock to schedule our time, to coordinate with others, to bring us all together in a workplace, for instance, at the same time so we could work together, all the things that were becoming important as society became more urban way back then, you also, once again, have a deeper effect. Suddenly people begin thinking more about measurable sequences of events and measurable time. And I don't think it's any coincidence that not long after the introduction of the mechanical clock, you see an explosion of scientific thinking. People are much more focused on cause and effect, on measuring things in the real world. And you have, beyond the introduction of the scientific method, you have the Enlightenment. These things aren't only caused, of course, by the technology. But it's pretty clear that as people adapted to this new way, this new tool for keeping time, they also adapted in a deep cognitive way. They adapted their minds to this tool as well. So I think looking across the history of intellectual technologies, what you see is that every time one of these technologies is introduced and then spreads broadly through society, it introduces what I call an intellectual ethic. And by that I simply mean that it emphasizes, the tool emphasizes some ways of using your mind, the ways it's built to help you with, but it de-emphasizes other ways of using your mind. And as it spreads, as it becomes more popular and more people adopt it, this way of thinking, this intellectual ethic, begins to spread through society. And over time, as a result, we do gain often stronger skills in some ways of thinking, some ways of using our mind, but at the same time, we begin to lose, or at least weaken, other ways of using our minds. And for a long time, this process, this influence of technology on people's thinking, both at a personal level and a societal level, was understood by historians and psychologists and others who study this. But what we didn't know is, how could this happen? What was the inner process within us that allowed a tool that we would use to reshape, in a way, the way we think? And it's only really recently, the last 40 years or so, that brain scientists have realized that, in fact, our brains are always adapting at a physical level, at a cellular level, to our circumstances. It used to be, before this discovery of what's called neuroplasticity, this adaptability of the brain through our lifetime, it used to be believed that, you know, once you hit about the age of 20, that was it. When you were a kid, all your connections between your neurons were solidified, and all your brain circuits came together, and that was it. You know, after you hit 20, it was this, you know, slow decay of your brain, and all your brain cells dying and never coming back. So it was a pretty dark picture of our mental lives. The good news is that's not true. That, in fact, our brains are always adapting throughout our entire lives. They certainly are more malleable when we're young, at our youngest, but it continues throughout the entire time you're alive. And when you think about it, it's a fairly simple and kind of obvious, even though we only really realized it, expression of a fact. Because it basically says that when you change your circumstances, when you change the environment in which you're thinking, then you change your mental habits. And when you change your mental habits, your brain adapts. It, in essence, optimizes itself to do whatever kind of thinking you're practicing a lot. But then any kind of thinking that you're not practicing a lot, those circuits begin to weaken, because your brain is very good at redeploying its resources for whatever you happen to be practicing. And as I say, on the one hand, that's a very good thing. That's what gives us adaptability, allows us to learn new things, learn new skills, get used to changes in our environment. But there's also a possible negative effect, because our brain doesn't care how it adapts. It's simply responding to the way we use it. So some of the ways of thinking that we might lose because we no longer practice them might, in fact, be very, very important ways of thinking. And so that brings me to what I think is the important question we have to ask ourselves when we think about the internet and digital media in general, and that is, what is the internet's intellectual ethic? What kinds of thinking does it promote and encourage and reinforce? And on the other hand, what kind of thinking does it discourage and end up weakening? And the reason this is so important with the internet is that this is the first time we've had an intellectual technology that we tend to use all the time. You know, more and more, particularly since the arrival of the smartphone and the tablet, but certainly dating back to laptop computers and so forth, this is a technology that we carry with us all day long. A lot of people, first thing they do when they get up in the morning, glance at their phone or glance at their computer, see what's going on, see if they got any texts or any new emails came in. Last thing they do before they go to bed, check it again. You wouldn't want to go to bed thinking you've missed some message. And if you wake up at 3 in the morning, well, check it once more. But when you think about it, we've really never had a technology that we're interacting with all the time and for all sorts of different purposes. Even television, when you think about it, even though people have always watched plenty of television, at least for the last few decades anyway, television was segregated to certain times in our lives. You know, you come home from work, say, and you might watch some TV, or you might watch some sports during the weekend, but you didn't go to work and have a television sitting in front of you that you watch, and you didn't carry one around in your pocket or your pocketbook all day long and keep glancing at it. So this is really something new in the world. And because we're interacting with the technology all the time, looking at it, consulting it, doing a whole range of different things with it, it, I think, has a particularly strong effect, neuroplastic effect, on shaping our brain, shaping the way we think. And anyone who's used the internet, I think if they are honest with themselves about the kind of intellectual environment, the kind of thinking it establishes, well, it's pretty obvious. On the one hand, it presents us with an incredibly information-rich environment. I mean, that's the fundamental characteristic of the internet, and one of the reasons we use it so much. We, as human beings, we naturally love information. We naturally love to know what's going on. So you present us with all sorts of ways to monitor things, and we do that. And if you look more deeply at kind of the fundamental technological characteristics of the internet, you see that they all contribute to this information-rich environment. So it's a technology of connectivity. It connects you not only with information in all sorts of forms, but also with other people. And we're being social beings. That's also another reason we like to use it so much. It's also a technology of multiplicity. There's never been a more powerful or flexible multimedia technology as the internet is. So, you know, it used to be you go to a book and you read text, you turn on your TV and you'd see moving pictures, you turn on your stereo and you'd listen to music. All of these things converge and come through the internet. And they often come through simultaneously. So you have an animation going on the screen and music going and text coming at you. We've never had a multimedia system so powerful as the net. There's also the velocity of information. And this is one of the most really incredible characteristics of the net. That we're trained, as you use it, you train yourself to expect immediate responses. You send out a text, you know, you expect to get a response back very quickly. If it doesn't come, you think, oh, boy, I thought this person was my friend, you know. Immediate response to the text. And you, same thing, you send out an email, you click on a link, you expect a new page of information to look at. When you look at companies like Google and Facebook, they measure people's attention span in microseconds, in fractions of a second, and they see that, you know, if it takes more than a half a second for a page to load, people will go off and look somewhere else. And when you consider it, this is really a radical change in our conception, another radical change in our conception of time. It used to be, you think of an hour or something, that's pretty quick. Now we think of fractions of a second, and we parcel out our days in fractions of a second and expect that kind of response. That's a good indicator in and of itself of how the technology shapes our perception of the world. And finally, and maybe most importantly of all, this is an incredibly interactive technology, unlike television or radio or most media technologies before. So in addition to monitoring things coming at us, we're also sending out information all the time. Again, another reason we use it so much, another reason we take pleasure in it, because we like to express ourselves. But all of these characteristics that make the internet such an information-rich environment also, by necessity, make it an interruption-rich environment. Basically, this technology is an incredibly powerful distraction machine. Whenever you carry a cell phone or smartphone with you, whenever you turn on your computer, you're basically entering an environment that keeps you perpetually distracted, perpetually interrupted. And you keep going back for more because it's useful and it's enjoyable and you like it. It's not for no reason that we enter this environment, and yet it is something that, if the entire history, last 100-year history of media has been of increasing the pace of interruptions and distractions, the internet and digital media takes this far, far beyond anything we've seen before. So the types of thinking that this environment encourages, of course, are types of thinking that require very rapid information processing, very quick shifts in focus, divided attention, trying to keep track of lots of things simultaneously. I think a good image, and I don't know if you can see this or not, to kind of encapsulate or summarize this environment is an image from a video game. Video games might be even more extreme than the internet, but a video game, to succeed, you have to keep track of all sorts of things going on at once. You can't focus your attention on one thing because that'll be it for your character very quickly. And so it encourages this very rapid shifts in focus, very rapid taking in of information. And the internet really in general, the computer screen in general, is very much a similar environment. It rewards divided attention. It rewards shifts in focus and the ability to juggle lots of incoming stimuli. And in fact, there have been various studies of video games, and one thing that comes through those, and this chart is some results from one of those studies, but since some of you, I guess, can't see it, I won't explain it, and besides, it takes a long time. But in essence, what the researchers did is they got a group of heavy video gamers and a group of people who didn't play video games, and they tested their ability to shift their focus and keep track of lots of things on a screen. And what they found pretty clearly is that video gamers are better at doing that. They have developed an increased visual acuity. So they're very good at dividing their attention and shifting their focus. And that's a good skill to have. There's nothing wrong with that. That can help you out. It's been shown that professions that require keeping track of lots of information, being a pilot or a surgeon, for instance, actually you can improve your skills if you do a lot of video gaming. It also, what this research also shows us is that, in effect, our brains adapt. And again, it's not a particular surprise. You would think that heavy video gamers would display greater skills in keeping track of lots of things. So the kind of thinking that the net encourages, it also appears to strengthen in our minds. But then we have to ask ourselves, what kind of thinking does the net discourage? And I think here too it's pretty clear. It discourages sustained attention. It has that effect that I felt when I sit down and try to read a book, which is that it wasn't enough stimulation. You suddenly train your brain to want to be distracted, to want to shift its focus. And so if you want an image of the kind of thinking that we seem to be sacrificing, would be Rodin's great sculpture of the thinker. You know, a guy sitting there with his chin on his fist. You know, he's probably not composing a tweet. And until recently, at least, this type of thinking, this very attentive, very deep thinking, was considered the highest form of human intellectual activity. In this, I think, we don't see this statue that much. It used to be until recently. Whenever somebody wanted to get across the image of deep thought, they'd use this statue of this person who was able to concentrate, able to focus his mind, able to screen out distractions and interruptions. And because the internet gives us very little opportunity and very little encouragement to engage in this type of thinking, and because, in fact, it keeps us distracted, keeps us interrupted, I fear that it's this form of thinking, the attentive form of thinking, that is weakening in us, in that we're, in fact, beginning to lose in favor of that more distracted, faster-paced form of thinking. And here, too, if you look at the science, you see all sorts of evidence that the net is discouraging attentive, focused thinking. So if you look, for instance, at various studies that are done of how people behave when they're online, you see all sorts of evidence of their inability to stop the flow of information and think deeply. There was a study of the average time that a person looks at a web page before they click and go somewhere else, and the researchers found that it was about 21 seconds. Then a few years later, some German researchers looked at the data and they realized that that actually was way high. That in fact, what the original research failed to do was take into account that sometimes you'll open a web page and then you'll go and check your email and do something else. And it'll still be open, but you're not really looking at it. So when they did a more careful study, they found that on average, we'll look at a web page for 10 seconds and then we'll go somewhere else. And they found, moreover, that it really doesn't matter how much information is on the page, whether it's text or anything else. It's about 10 seconds, and then you click, and you're gone. One of the conclusions that, for instance, web design consultants tell people is you have to assume that people aren't going to really look at the information. They're going to glance at it very, very quickly and then move on. There was also an interesting study a few years ago about how many times people look at their email inboxes when they're at work and they have a computer open in front of them. And the researchers went out and they asked people, and they said, on average, we probably check it 3 or 4 times an hour. And then they actually fitted them with these goggles, these eye-tracking goggles, that keep track of where you look on a screen, and they found that on average they were glancing at their inbox 30 or 40 times an hour, 10 times more than they were even conscious that they were doing. If you look at texting among American teenagers, and this is a number I have to keep increasing every time a new study comes out, but the average American teen sends or receives a text about 3,300 times a month. And for teenage girls, it's actually over 4,000 texts a month. And if you look at any one of these things, and I could go on with Google searches or whatever, if you look at these in isolation, you might say, well, you know, that's a lot of information to take in, but still, you know, we can handle it. But you can't look at each of these in isolation. These are cumulative. People are texting and checking Facebook and checking email and jumping from page to page online and doing all the other sorts of things we do online. And all of these distractions accumulate. And what you get a picture of is really minds that are never able to concentrate on one thing for more than a few seconds when you're online. And I think the trends in the internet are keep pushing us more and more in that direction. In fact, if you look at the guiding metaphor of how information is presented online, we've gone through a shift in recent years. We've gone from the web page, which might have had a lot of stuff going on, but at least it was kind of a page where you could go and look. That's no longer the way most people experience the net. We've gone from the page to the stream of information. So stuff coming at you constantly, all the time, whether it's through Twitter or through Facebook or through RSS feeds for headlines, even Google searches now, you know, every time you put in a new letter, the page refreshes itself. And again, this further accentuates this constant distraction we feel. You see similar evidence of this when you look at how people tend to read when they're online. And this evidence also comes from those eye-tracking studies where you put goggles on. Again, I don't know how clearly you can see this, but this is the results of one of the studies, and these are three different pages on the screen. And if you look, the dark red or orangish-red areas, those are areas of high visual focus. The yellow ones are kind of weakening focus, and the blue areas are just cursory focus. And what you see over and over again from these tests is that we tend to read words on a page in what's called an F pattern. So your eyes go all the way across the first couple of lines of text, then they drift down a little, then you go about halfway across a couple of lines, and then it just tails off and you kind of glance down the margin. And what this shows us is that what we want to do, and what we do when we're online, is try to get information as quickly as possible, get the gist of something, and then get out and get on to something new. And in isolation, there's nothing wrong with this. We've skimmed newspapers this way for a long time. Having the ability to skim and scan information is just as important as the ability to read carefully and deeply. But what you see over and over again is this very cursory way of reading becomes our default way of reading when we're online. We're not encouraged to read in the way that, say, a printed book tends to encourage us to read. So who cares? Why is this important? Why don't we just say, well, fine, you know, we're getting good at taking in lots of information very quickly, and we're not so good at concentrated, attentive thinking, but is that really so bad? Well, I think if you look at some of the basic brain processes that determine the richness of our thinking, you begin to see why there's a big negative consequence to this. And one of the most important things to understand is how our brain creates memories. There are various kinds of memory that we have, but you can kind of draw a distinction between two types. Short-term working memory, this is the kind of memories that come into us constantly when we go about our waking lives. It's basically the contents of your consciousness. It's what you're working on in your mind. So every kind of stimuli that comes out of you, what you see, information you take in, that's held in your working memory. And what characterizes working memory is its extraordinarily small capacity. You can only keep about 2 to 4 elements of information in your working memory at any given time. Our long-term memory, the other kind of memory, has a huge capacity. If working memory is a thimble, long-term memory is kind of a bathtub. No one knows of any limit, really, to how much you can keep in memory. And the richness of your thinking hinges on your ability to move information from your working memory over to your long-term memory. Because that's the time when you create connections between the facts you learn, the experiences you have, the emotions you feel. And it's those connections that really are the basis for the highest levels of conceptual thinking, critical thinking, some kinds of creative thinking. The problem is, if your short-term working memory is overloaded, if you're taking in too much information, if you're constantly distracted, that process of transferring information to your long-term memory, what scientists call consolidation, it never happens. Because what does happen is, in order to make room for new information coming into your consciousness, coming into your working memory, other information has to leave. And you never pay attention long enough to information. You never rehearse it in your mind long enough to transfer it over to long-term memory. As a result, a lot of your thinking remains shallow. You're just processing little individual bits of information without ever weaving it together into knowledge. And there's beginning to be, and we're at the very early stages of the scientific examination of this phenomenon, but there's growing evidence that, in fact, when we spend a lot of time with divided attention online, with doing a lot of multitasking rather than focusing on one thing, in fact, our thinking does become shallower. There was a very interesting study done at Stanford in 2009. The researchers gathered two groups of people. One group did a whole lot of online multitasking. The other group did very little. And then they gave them a battery of 6 different tests of their cognitive function. Basically looking at how well they could control their own thoughts and their own thinking. And the heavy multitaskers did worse on all of the 6 tests. One of the most interesting tests, and this is from that, was a test of people's ability to distinguish important information from trivia. And what they found is that the more you're distracted, the more you're multitasking, your ability to make distinctions between the importance of information goes substantially down. Essentially, what you come to want is simply new information. And it doesn't matter if it's important or not. Just the fact that it's new is what you begin to crave. And so there's evidence that, you know, you might have an important task or an important reading or something in front of you, and you know it's important, and you might even really want to involve yourself with that. But if you sense there's some new information out there that you might see, even if it's trivial, you'll shift your focus and go for the new information. The head researcher, Clifford Nass, summed it up as saying that heavy online multitaskers are suckers for irrelevancy. They just crave the new. And even another interesting thing is one of the 6 tests they gave was multitasking skill, how good you are at shifting between different tasks. Even there, the heavy multitaskers did worse. And that was something that actually surprised the researchers. They thought that, you know, at least heavy multitasker can be good at multitasking. It doesn't seem to be true. If you ask people, heavy multitaskers, if they're good at it, they'll say, oh yeah, I can switch between things all, you know, I can do 7 different things at once. And they can, but they don't do any of them very well, is what the tests seem to show. So, when you look across the evidence, both evidence from kind of earlier studies of hypertext and computer interfaces and more recent studies of the web, what becomes apparent is that we are making an important mental trade-off for all the time and all the effort we put into being online. And again, in 2009, a developmental psychologist at UCLA named Patricia Greenfield, who's been studying the effects of different media, different technology, on thinking and learning for a number of decades now. She started off looking at television. She looked across more than 50 different studies of the effects of media technologies on our thinking. And she came to the conclusion, based on looking at all of them, that indeed screen media, computer media, online media, does build new strengths in visual spatial intelligence. That kind of thing we saw with the video gamers' ability to shift their focus, visual focus, very quickly. But she went on, the cost is a weakening of mindful knowledge acquisition, inductive analysis, critical thinking, imagination, and reflection. So, however much you might value the ability to shift your focus more quickly, and that's an important skill, I think most of us would agree that these things that we seem to be losing, imagination, reflection, critical thinking, and so on, are extraordinarily important, and extraordinarily important to the richness of our personal intellectual lives, and I think extraordinarily important to society, because a lot of the progress in society comes from people who can do this kind of thinking, all of which requires attentiveness and not this state of perpetual distraction. In one way, I think you could argue that the, this is from the movie Year One, which is terrible. I think in one very important way, you could say that the types of thinking that the net encourages are very primitive types of thinking. It's pretty clear that we have a very primitive instinct to want to know everything that's going on around us. And you can understand that back, you know, cavemen and cavewomen will probably increase their odds of surviving if they knew everything that was going on around them. So they were inspired to do that. Unfortunately, what we've done is we've created for ourselves an environment in which there's no limit to the amount of stuff that we can keep track of. And so we bring this primitive instinct into this new environment, and we keep ourselves permanently distracted. We're constantly striving to get new information from new sources, constantly shifting our focus. It's useful to contrast with this type of thinking the kind of thinking that was inspired by one of the crucial intellectual technologies that the web is pushing aside, the net is pushing aside, and that's the technology of the printed book, kind of the central intellectual technology of the last 500 years or so. Today, you know, you pick up a book, a printed book, and you look at it, and there seems to be some, you know, it's not giving you a lot of stimulation. You can't look at it and check your email or send a text or anything. We kind of think of this as a drawback to the technology, that there's only one function it does, and that's present words, really, and force you to read them. But I think it's really the great strength of the book, the printed book, as a tool or as a technology. What that does, what the page does, is it, in effect, trains you to filter out distractions, to resist that primitive urge to interrupt your thinking by taking in new things. The book, kind of as a technology, provides a screen against that distraction, and I think you could make the argument that it trained people over a long period of time. It trained human beings to be more attentive, to go against their natural inclination to have divided focus and divided attention. And if you look at the statistics, what you see is not that we're just in a period of transition from print technology to screen technology. We've already made the transition. There was a study recently that looked at people's media use throughout the day. And what I found is that the average American today spends about 8.5 hours looking at a screen, TV, computer, cell phone, any type of screen. And that same average American spends about 20 minutes reading from the printed page. So we have, in effect, in this obviously different individuals have different experiences, but as a society, we've decided to get rid of this intellectual technology that encourages attentiveness, encourages deep thinking, focused thinking, in favor of a technology that keeps us distracted, teaches us to shift our focus, but doesn't give us much motivation to think very, very deeply and very conceptually about things. So let me just sum up with what I think the science is telling us, and if we're honest with ourselves, I think what a lot of our personal experience, which is just as important as the science, is telling us about the web and its effects, intellectual effects. I think it's important, again, to emphasize that the internet gives us enormous benefits. I mean, the reason we use it so much is because we like it and it's useful in so many ways. It is pretty clear that when it comes to gathering information quickly and filtering information quickly, the net marks a huge leap forward in progress. Suddenly, information that was really hard to come by, expensive, existed somewhere else in the world, suddenly you can get that almost immediately. And it does seem to be, our use of it does seem to be improving certain visual skills. Not only shifting your focus, but also pattern recognition. So seeing patterns in an array of different data, which is, again, an important skill. And it certainly gives many people new ways to express themselves, whether it's YouTube with videos or blogs or tweets or whatever. A lot of people find new avenues for creative expression. And finally, and very important, is certain types of problem solving that require collaboration seem to be heightened by the net, because it is an incredible platform for collaboration, sharing information quickly. And up until now, we've tended to focus on those benefits. But I think it's important, particularly as we constantly ratchet up our use of the technology, to realize that there are large costs involved in our dependence on it as well. At a practical matter, there's some signs that in businesses, for instance, that people are so distracted these days that their productivity is going down. They think they're really busy, but they're not really accomplishing much. And that's one of the practical drawbacks of all this multitasking. We seem to be sacrificing some of the deepest sources of creativity. In particular, it seems to be that attentiveness is really essential to having ideas that go against the grain of common wisdom. So you can use the internet and think the way everybody else does really quickly, but if you want to have people that really think in new ways and go against the grain of common thought, you really have to have people who pay attention and really go deeply into one subject matter, really pay attention to their own train of thought or whatever. And if you lose those people, you lose some of those counterintuitive ideas, very, very creative ideas. We also seem to be sacrificing personal knowledge building. That all depends on your ability to consolidate long-term memories and weave them together into personal knowledge. If that process is being blocked by an overloaded working memory, then you sacrifice personal knowledge building as well. We certainly seem to be sacrificing opportunities for solitary contemplation and reflection. In fact, you see in some sectors a dismissal of solitary thinking and contemplation and reflection and being kind of outdated, which I think is a shame, because it seems to me that despite all the benefits of collaboration and exchanging messages, there are some incredibly important ways of thinking that you can only do by yourself when you're thinking deeply. And finally, I think as we shift in this direction personally, we do begin to erode some of the foundations of cultural richness, because, as I said before, you need people who can pay attention to one thing if you're going to have progress in the arts, sciences, pretty much anywhere. Let me end with a quote from the late novelist David Foster Wallace. Back in 2005, he gave a commencement address at Kenyon College, I think it was. And it was a very eloquent speech about the importance of being able to pay attention and control your mind. And one thing he said was, learning how to think means being conscious and aware enough to choose what you pay attention to, and to choose how you construct meaning from experience. I think maybe the biggest danger of the net is by changing our relationship to this technology from being the master of it and using it for particular purposes that we want to get done to being its servant, we also begin to sacrifice our control over our thinking and our control over what we pay attention to and what we don't pay attention to. And it seems to me that he was right, that if you sacrifice that, your control over your own thoughts, you sacrifice something incredibly important about the human intellect and the human mind. So thank you all for your attention.
We often live in a culture that is dominated by narcissism, by instant gratification, by mindlessness, and by what I call instagram. The internet embodies all of those things. And so, you know, in my mind, the prospect of creating a world that's even scarier than the one actually creating this novel. I want to look around us today, right? What people talk about during the presidential campaign, the world basically, going down the tube, and people are only worried about, superficial gossip, it seems to me that the internet actually, if I were Oliver Stone, I would direct a movie in which the internet is part of conspiracy. The American people even more infantile and idiotic than we already are. It seems to me that this is a real problem. And this is why education is going down the toilet too, right? Because people don't want to spend their time thinking about it because they're having too much fun.
The question or comment was that this probably has an effect on public discourse, on political discourse, and I think inevitably it would. I think if we live in a culture and an environment that encourages us to only take in little bits of information very quickly, then you're going to see a superficiality in public discourse and in our ability to think deeply about problems and whatever side of the political spectrum you're on. I think I really demonize the internet because I think this kind of shortening of attention spans and the shortening of messages has been going on for a long time, even at very important levels in government and society. But I do think that the internet tends to exaggerate or at least amplify those negative consequences for public conversation. Anybody else? Yeah? So the question was that it was from a student, a college student, that more and more, even in educational settings, you're pretty much expected to do everything online, to get your texts online, to do your studies online, submit papers online, and whether this affects the quality of education. I do think that in general we're moving too quickly, without considering the possible negative consequences, to push everybody online all the time. And I think this is why, some people say to me, well, isn't this just a matter of personal choice and personal discipline, just stop using it. And on the one hand, there's always choice and discipline involved, but I think what we're seeing is society reshaping itself around the technology of the net. And we've done this before with other technologies, automobiles and so forth. But what happens is that because the net is more efficient in many ways, everything gets pushed there. So you go to work, and kind of the expectation is that you're always connected, whether you're in your office or at home, and you kind of fear that your career is going to suffer if you're not responding to messages very quickly. You go to school, and everything's online, like you say, and so you can't disconnect because you flunk out very, very quickly. And then people socialize, particularly young people's. If all your friends are planning their social lives, exchanging information online, then it becomes very hard to back away because you feel socially isolated. So I think all of these things make it, are kind of pushing us down this direction very, very quickly. In fact, so quickly that we're not pausing enough and saying, you know, that this might be more convenient in a way to have all your texts online, or might be, you know, more efficient, but is there something we lose in the interaction, the unique kind of interaction we have when we have an object in the real world, a real book or a real thing that we interact with? Yeah. Okay, that's a complicated question. I don't know if I can summarize it, but basically, because our brains are limited, you know, they're only as big as our skull, and so they only fit so many neurons and stuff, is this just a way to extend the power of our brain by taking in more information from the environment by extending mind? And I think in one sense it is. And I mean, this has been true of a lot of technology, books and everything. As soon as you have the ability to store information outside your brain, then you can get access to it. And there are many benefits to that. So I think that that's true in one sense, that by increasing the speed with which you can gather information that's stored externally to you, you increase your certain kinds of capacity for thinking. But at the same time, it's encouraging certain ways of thinking, and that what you might sacrifice as a result, as I said, and I think this is one of the most important things, is the internal development of knowledge. Because there was an interesting study recently that showed that the more people think that they can Google something, the less likely they are to remember it. So you begin to simply depend on the stuff outside, and you never create those unique connections inside your own mind. One more? Yes? Yeah. So the question is, you know, is there now research that goes beyond figuring out what the symptoms are to helping us solve the problem? And I think, and I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm sure there's research going on that will illuminate some of these, you know, some of the sacrifices we make mentally when we're overloaded and so forth, and that might help us. For instance, it might help software programmers take that into account. Up until now, you know, computer programmers have basically gone on the assumption that more is better. And the faster you get information to people, the better. My hope is, and you see some signs of this in certain kinds of reading applications and so forth, that we might shift and begin to think about the quality of our thinking that the software inspires, rather than just the speed with which it comes at us. So I have, even since the book came out, I have been encouraged that there seems to be more discussion about the possible negative consequences, and even in, you know, even among technologists, there seems to be a growing awareness that something, we might have gone too far. Whether that, on the other hand, there's this huge momentum, technological momentum, to keep going down the same path, so it's hard to know, you know, how much are we really going to change? Thank you again.